This is the Made in Nature podcast. I'm Carl Moore. Today's guest is Bill Patridge, an electronics technician, a musician, music writer, and more recently a volunteer hospice worker from Houston, Texas, where he's been living for about two decades. Bill originally grew up on the East Coast in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and left home with his guitar and headed west at the ripe old age of 17. Eventually ending up in Southern California. That's where I met up with Bill. By that time, he'd been living for about 10 years in San Diego and was working as an electronics technician with his newly acquired electronics degree at Hughes Aircraft Company in Carlsbad. Myself being recently an import from Dublin, Ireland, Bill introduced me to new friends, the desert, and the writings of Carlos Castaneda involving the Yaqui shaman Don Juan Matus. Bill was also a fan of words, as I remember him. He seemed to always keep a dictionary nearby, which instilled in me an interest, if not a challenge, to find a word he had not heard of before. He always had his guitar with him, and if he couldn't hold it, he was jamming out some riff through his mouth. It's been over 20 years since we've really talked. While Bill always had a spiritual awareness, he has become more involved than ever into the study of consciousness, the afterlife, and is convinced that we are not alone in the universe and that we go on after this life. In vain with the theme of this podcast, namely to explore our continuous and deep connection to a unified realm, the question of spirit and life after death becomes of relevance. Perhaps it may be thought of more as a sublime aspect of our connection to nature and the cosmos. Bill, welcome to the Made in Nature podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl.
Great stuff.
Yeah. Good morning from Houston.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Yeah, what's the weather like out there?
It's kind of rainy, nothing torrential, which is nice and peaceful. There's a general air of quietude about things, which is perfect for a Saturday morning.
Oh, good. It sounds like Ireland. We're getting some hot weather today. It'll probably go lower, though. So I bet you never thought you'd be doing a podcast with me, huh?
It's the first time I've done a podcast, period.
Yeah, well, actually, you're my first interviewee. So you have that honor and title forever.
All right. the big intro, yes.
So it seems today now your big focus is in music and hospice work. And they're not separate things either. You've combined them in an interesting way. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, that was kind of incidental. Through a path that we'll explore later on, and ended up doing hospice volunteer work because of my interest in what happens beyond death to consciousness. And it was discovered that I'm a musician, that I perform. And my supervisor asked if I might not, they'd been getting requests from musicians to go to the, you know, to play bedside by hospice, but for the dying people. So I gave it a shot, and it was a unique experience. The very first one was an old woman. I thought she had Alzheimer's, and mm-hmm. I was told she liked classical music. And I'm not a classical music musician, but I'm an improviser from day one, completely self-taught. So I went in here, there was classical music going on her radio. She was rocking back and forth in her rocking chair. And apparently quite unaware of what's going on in her surroundings. Obviously, her music soothes her. So I'm sitting there, my first time to play in front of, you know, other than just sitting with a patient and talking with them, which is normally the course for a volunteer. So I carefully got my guitar out and said, well, I'll just kind of play notes along with the music that's being played on a radio. I did this for about 2 minutes before, you know, we all experience those electrical blips where mm-hmm. in a building where you see a quick little sag and lights might dim for a brief second. Well, this happened when it did. When this power surge took place, it turned the music off.
While I was playing,
this thing happened so that the music was silenced other than me playing. And wow. I definitely, anecdotal or not, I definitely got the sense that something just happened. So wow, that was a unique experience for me, and I've been getting nothing but positive. You know, I did that for about 3 or 4 more patients before I had to tend to my dying sister on the East Coast.
So how many years?
Now I'm working on actually consciously combining the two of writing songs for the dying, if you will. So this is starting to become, you know, the two areas are starting to meld.
Yeah. So, but you've always sort of have that spiritual awareness aspect ever since I met you. But there must have been a time. Was there a time when this kind of it accelerated? Because I know you had a few changes in careers. You know, like you were an electronics technician in Hughes, and I remember the day you went from temporary to permanent, and you came in with the shirt and tie. And with your badge, and you were shaving, and you let us all down, man. That didn't last long, but as the gods would have it, you changed careers. So just getting back, what point did you sort of accelerate this or feel that this is more your path?
The near-death studies, or the post-death explorations. You know, I've always been into, like you said, spiritual matters, whether it be UFOs or the brain and consciousness. I've always been a science geek, if you will, not nearly as applied and advanced of you, you know, but I've always been completely involved with the scientific viewpoint, you know. It's just that death has been pretty prominent in my life. My mom died when I was 9 years old, and that had a huge impact on me. And then it seems like ever since then, my life has been adaptation mode, constantly having to adapt to new situations, never a resting point. When you live a life like that, not knowing what to expect, you acquire certain mechanisms, defense mm-hmm. mechanisms, coping mechanisms. And so I don't know if those things were part of the cause of my interest in consciousness study, but
How old were you at the time when your mom passed?
I was 9 years old, and I was really tight with my mom, like my sister was tight with my dad.
When did you take up guitar? Was that before or after?
I picked up guitar when I was 10. The year after she died, it was my dad, my sister, and I living in a little townhouse while he was starting up his business out of the den. And I found his old ukulele stuffed up in the closet one day. And I just sat it on my lap. And because I've always been self-occupied, I've never, you know, I enjoy friends. And I enjoy myself when there's nobody around. That's never been a thing with me. I don't understand the meaning of lonely. So I was just sitting here and playing it on my lap with two thumbs, you know. Nobody in my family did music at all. Nobody did art of any kind. My mom had been encouraging of those things. We had always had a piano in the house. And I think back, and she let me just plod along on that piano, just playing random notes for hours at a time. I never think about that when people ask me when I started playing music. I usually cite the 10-year-old ukulele.
Yeah, but it seems like it's always been there.
In retrospect, it's always been there.
But getting back to this, I'm kind of switching between the two things here because I know you're blending them as well, so maybe it's appropriate. But if some people can consider this. I was thinking the juxtaposition, you know, is this your obsession with or fascination with death? Is it a morbid sort of thing to be doing? And I was thinking in my own mind that, you know, I've heard the hospice environment isn't so much as a sad and somber place, but one where people are real because there's no time for bullshit. And and money doesn't mean anything, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's one of the attractions?
that was definitely one of the, I've always been, especially since my dad passed in 2014, something triggered then that specifically accelerated my studies of extraterrestrials and the near-death experience. You know, it just happened right after he died, and I could not consume enough information. And I've read over 50 books on the ET subject. I've read over 100 books and peer-reviewed studies and other papers in the Lancet, you know, and whatnot on near-death studies and the afterlife, if you will.
So, if I may say, Bill, it's the ETs are in there with the spirit world. So would you, you don't necessarily see them as extraterrestrial, but perhaps more extra-dimensional. Would that be, or is it a mixture?
Without getting too far into the weeds as far as other dimensions and whatnot, because that gets really on the theoretical plane and doesn't have so much pertinence as to why I study what I do. But okay. I will say non-terrestrial intelligences, you know. I don't research it anymore. I keep up to date with what is disclosed to the public, but I don't research it anymore because I've got my answers, and it seems pretty clear to me that we've been monitored for thousands and if not millions of years. There's many. I mean, there are millions of civilizations in this galaxy alone. Some of them are concerned with the planet and keeping the planet healthy, like other planets in the galaxy, in the universe. Mm-hmm. Some of them are concerned with our species and the evolution of the human species on planet Earth. So there's those concerns there. There are many different types. And, you know, the old Drake equation, this preposterous formula they came up with for determining the likelihood of there being intelligent life. Well, it's all based upon technological components.
Oh, yeah, so yeah, yeah. Well, it's only good as the...
Incomplete. Yeah, it's incomplete from the get-go.
Yeah, well, it's based on erroneous assumptions, because if you go on the idea that everything is connected and consciousness seems to be everywhere, then life could be everywhere. So,
well, I usually counter that with our own protocols for field biologists. For instance, the prime example would be a field biologist.
Okay.
You know, 100 years ago, a field biologist would just go out in the field, grab their goods, probably stuff and mount it, bring it back to the museum. These days, there's very specific reasons for non-interference when doing your explorations and collecting your data.
Yeah, yeah.
And that protocol seems to be a universal protocol as far as civilizations visiting other civilizations.
Well,
the level, the difference in the level of advancement.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Bill. I was just sort of thinking like, that's the thing in physics is if you're trying to measure something, in measuring it, you don't want to change what you're trying to measure.
It's impossible.
So, yeah, it's impossible to minimize it. And that's what a good experiment is when you interfere with it in the least possible way, because then you get a more realistic picture of what's going on. So I just wanted to add that in there.
Well, that's the big point that both encompasses ET involvement as well as the afterlife aspects of reality. And where were we going with that?
Well, we were talking about. Yeah, we were talking about the biology, and we seem to be talking about different layers or different higher, you know, other civilizations. And I was also thinking of different, because the universe is a layered structure. And so the thing is, you're talking about connections in this world, but now it's kind of into the afterlife, the other dimensional connection. And I think that's...
Oh, yeah, free will. This is the apex of what I was getting to. This has to do with free will and when we come to this life, because this gets into reincarnation, and the place between lives that I'll just call home, because that's how it's described by people who have been there and come back. It's described as home, real home.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you're going to talk about between these worlds as being home. So what are these worlds? One of them is this world, and the other is on the other side of this.
Okay. Planet. Well, typically, usually I start off with a conversation about, the out of body experiences, because you can't start talking about deeper layers of reality until you talk about the old, quote unquote problem of brain versus consciousness. And I think that it's obvious that consciousness is not produced by the brain. The brain, to me, is obviously a filter. It's a transceiver. It doesn't create the consciousness. It's the mechanism by which consciousness can interact with this reality and this, what we've agreed upon to be a three-dimensional linear time-based reality.
Yeah.
That's what the brain was. The brain was designed as an interface.
Yeah, I would go with that 100%, because it's like, there's parts of the brain that control parts of the body and stuff, and there's certain places where there's short-term and long-term memory, but I think there's another memory where it's not actually within the skull. It's like,
right,
because consciousness is everywhere, so it's more holographic, because you have all these vibrational fields, and the brain is an organ of picking that up, a receiver. And transmitter,
right.
And the heart is too, but in a different way. And maybe we'll talk about that later. But definitely, we're connected by these organs to another dimensional realm. And so,
like your own work,
which is kind of interesting, you're dealing with you're acting as a bridge between the worlds, and you're also using music. And I find that music is just really just patterns of harmony. And
yes,
I'm, and that becomes a therapy in itself. A therapy to death.
It amplifies your own emotion. It amplifies and reflects your own emotional state. So if you're in a place that's good, that gets transmitted and affects the other person directly. Emotions are a direct form of communication. It's nothing left brain about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's, I'm reminded of the fact that the brain can only process so much information, but the body is continuously aware of itself at the cellular level and at other levels of organization, so that it's like, I don't know, some like a million times more bits of data. And so it doesn't translate that into a language, but as a, I guess, a feeling or sensation first, and as a feeling, and it's all,
exactly.
It's all at that level. And that becomes a part of the intuitive side of the person. If you can connect with that, you can develop that. And also a sense of the other dimensions in the afterlife, I guess.
So. Yes. Yeah. If you can get yourself into that space, which we can define as the theta state, if you will, the various levels of consciousness that we can measure scientifically, the alpha, beta, delta, and theta state. The theta state is the deepest state.
Yeah,
it's the one that hypnotherapists access in order to explore this area I'm calling home.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that, because kids, they say that they're in a more or less a theta state until.
Well, when we first enter this world, we're all wave, if you will, and no particle, and we're all theta. We're still connected. We don't have the tools developed to communicate left brain wise in a linear communication system. We weren't born that way. This all has to be learned and acquired. Until that point, we're still quite connected.
Well, would you say though that, the explanation part is really part of the left brain side?
Linear is left brain, I believe, and right brain is great. I might have it backwards.
I think right brain is the creative. Yeah, I have. I know this.
Okay, we're on the same page then.
Yeah, well, it's. where was I going with that? What I was saying was is the fact that you have to explain it is only, it's really just one part of the brain that's doing it, but you can realize it at another level. And that's the level, you know, when you meditate, you go deep into that central core of one's being. And, you know, they say, well, you can't really describe it, but it's everything. And so you go to the
beyond.
You go to, yeah. These, you know, it's nothing, but it's everything. And you're at that place where there's, it seems to be a dimensionless realm, but at the same time, it seems to be like, if you go there, you can connect with everything.
Through, it's all pervasive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes to the point that when we're born on this planet, there's a memory block for everything that happened before, or we wouldn't be able to function. It's too much information to process at one time.
So in this place that you call home, does one realize, because, well, maybe for the listeners here, I mean, obviously we're talking because we're both of the belief, let's say, are convinced that life goes on afterwards and that we can have many lives. And this is part of the development of the soul, and that the yes. Earth is an arena for us to develop and to mature.
A very unique place.
Right, exactly. So did you want to just continue on that vein?
Yeah. When we're there, we generally, when we incarnate, when we go through our incarnations, we have what's called soul groups. And this is a group of beings. We're all, and we incarnate together. In one life, this person may be your mother. In the next life, it may be your son. We play all these different roles, and this brings to the point that the question of evil, the purpose of evil, and these are all things related to this world here, this matrix, if you will, that was designed to experience contrasts.
That's
both
interesting.
Good and bad. It's somebody has to play the role of the bad guy.
Yeah, you know, interesting you say that, because I know that, you know, what's going on in the world now, we see a lot what could be described as evil, and a lot of what could be described as good, and the way the media goes, you can get sucked into this very negative area and blaming, and that actually takes away your power. But
fear.
The way that I've dealt with this disorder is the good and bad are really just the forces of transformation that are necessary. And, you know, even in the Bible, it says Isaiah, God created both good and evil, which was quite a surprise to me. I thought that God was, a superhero fighter against evil, but he created both. So that just sort of backs up what you're saying. So,
yeah. And that's the most difficult, I think, nut for people to wrap their minds around that aren't used to this kind of subject matter. You know, you can't come at them out of the blue with a statement like that. because they take it personally, and they even go to the extent of thinking that I'm in collusion or I'm evil for even suggesting it. But that's the fact. You know, we're all familiar with plays and theater, and just because somebody plays Mephistopheles doesn't mean they're actually that way. They did it, they pulled it off effectively or not. That's all that matters.
Right. Who was that guy?
We have a role to play. Those are probably the most difficult roles to play.
Okay, who was that guy? Who was that guy you mentioned? Who was that Mephistopheles?
Mephistopheles? That's another one of the devil's many names.
Who is he again? Oh, Beelzebub. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Faust. I think that was the name used in connection with Faust.
Okay, that's the tempting evil one.
Yeah,
it comes in different forms. Okay.
Yeah.
I knew I'd heard it before.
So about this home, this is where we, when we come back, when we die and come back home, usually when you die, the first thing that happens is there's a point of transition where you either go into this, you find yourself in a zone, usually completely dark, completely warm and enveloping, sort of a loving stasis, you know, or some people, you know, you've heard of the tunnel and that's very prominent in most people that are living in the West. Things are slightly different when you get into other cultures, but I'm more and more convinced that this tunnel is a vortex.
Well, that's
based partly on some of the things that you've studied and have disclosed in your book, Nature's Twist. It got me thinking that this tunnel might be a vortex by design.
I have no doubt that it is. And just for the listeners, the tunnel you're talking about is similar to the near-death experience, the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's
exactly, well, that's where they get that expression from. Because people are in this tunnel, in a matter of times, they find themselves accelerating at an accelerating rate. And it's not unpleasant. And then they notice a small light in the distance, and all of a sudden things get brighter. And next thing you know, they're out of the tunnel. And they're usually greeted by at least one being of light. It's always described as a being of light.
It's funny. It's quite fascinating that you find these commonalities from different people, different cultures. As you were saying that, I was thinking of those experiments that were done with DMT, Richard Strauss out in New Mexico. And even though it was in a clinical setting, he found that when people were given a certain dosage of it, they would all seem to experience the same sort of state, encounter almost the same thing, described slightly differently. I think it was a bunch of these small little round little creatures would come out and want to play with them. I can't remember all the details, but there was this huge commonality, which, you know, for, you know, in the theme of this podcast is this connection. So when I see commonalities, even though they are, you know, intangible and probably even extra dimensional, the fact that there's a commonality found reported by different peoples without regard to culture, etc., seems to give it quite a lot of validity.
To me, it does. You know, there's nothing better than empirical evidence. I mean, it's nice to be able to present a paper to the scientific community, the orthodoxy, and have it approved. That's all great and important in its own way, but that's not all there is to knowledge.
Well, you know, the thing is with the scientific method is that it depends on repeatability. You need to repeat the experiment. But when you're dealing with energy, one of the things is as soon as you measure it and you're dealing with subtle energies, the very act of measuring it changes it slightly. So when you measure it again, it's not the same as it was.
Yeah.
And okay, that can sound like a cop-out that you can never, that's the reason why
it's not a cop-out. But
that's just the nature of it. That's
the recognition of the nature of it. That's all.
Yeah, right. But I suppose when these accounts come about independently all over the place, that's the way the evidence comes in, I think.
Yes.
Really because of the numbers that are beyond chance.
Well, there's a cross-reference of similar encounters, similar descriptions. The parameters of this description seem to be pretty well defined. And then with some of these experiences, there's something that's called veridical experience. And that's where information that can't be gotten in any other way is gotten. For instance, if you're having an out-of-body experience, mm-hmm. and you float out of your body and you float up to the next building on the fifth floor above you and see this sneaker lodged underneath the air conditioning unit. You see the brand, you see the way the shoelace is tucked under the sole, and then zap, you wake up and you go, whoa, that was pretty impressive. And you describe it to your caretaker, you know, because you're in a hospital and you blanked out for a second. That's why you had the out-of-body experience. You describe it to this person, they go out, and I'm describing an actual event. This person, this doctor, then goes out, goes to that very specific spot mentioned, finds it. I mean, there was no possible way, it's not information that could have been overheard from the staff and the operator. There is no possible way for that information to be known. That is called veridical experience. Veritas, the truth is in the Latin root.
Yeah, and for that, the very fact that it happens even once out of 1,000 times,
probability still,
it does not negate it.
No,
so it's a different form of evidence, I would say.
But, well, there's the white crow theory, is that you only need to prove, in order to disprove that all crows are black, you only need to find one white crow. Now that's not scientific because that's not a repeatable thing.
Yeah.
For instance, in most cases, but that's a fact. I mean, there's not a blanket answer in most cases. There are exceptions. There are reasons for the exceptions.
Right. So, Bill, listen, we're on this Zoom thing, and I think I think I've got 40 or 45 minutes.
Really? That much already?
Yeah, it could go on, because when we were talking before, it seemed to go on. But just in case it cuts, well, we're going to bring you back, so we'll talk about other things as well. But those other things, I just wanted to ask you, how do you see yourself going in the next few years? How do you see the environment changing? What is your focus going to be on in the future?
Yeah, well, I have a high degree of autonomy now, so I am retired, and this recent experience with this global pandemic and the behavior of people has caused me to shift my plans. Because I'm facing the fact that I'm going into the last third of my life, mm-hmm. and I want to do the most of what I've got left. And I don't want to be near a heavily concentrated population center. I'm choosing for the first time in my life the kind of environment that I want to actually live in. You know, Carlos Castaneda would say, you know, where I choose to do my dance with death, if you will.
Yeah, I understand that.
I've been appalled to the bone, the behavior of the public. And the only things that matter to me is manifesting music and helping the dying. Those are the only two things that matter to me. Outside of that, I want to be in nature. So yeah. I'm moving from the swampland of Houston, Texas, almost the third most populous city in this most powerful country on the planet, and I'm moving to New Mexico. Okay. To the high desert. I love the desert. It's where I find my peace. I'm going to be able to walk off my yard and practically be in the mountains. But I can build a studio there, do my music. I'll be close enough to Albuquerque to where I can do hospice work. If we come out of this apocalyptic situation and you can start interacting with people again, then well, there'll be a place where I can do my hospice work. If not, I can start doing it remotely in conjunction with this music I'm developing.
Yeah, it's all kind of good. It's funny, these circumstances that have come about, kind of, I found it myself, and you may be finding it, I sort of feel that I have to just do it, get in the canoe and go down the river instead of worrying about the canoe all the time, just get in it and go somewhere and start to do stuff. Because, you know, this whole thing of death, as you get older, you see it. But as Don Juan would say, is like death is your friend. And there's a lot of power in that, realizing that live every day just as though it's your own. That's kind of scary in a way.
Well, that's why it's important to choose a path with heart.
Well, there you go.
Choose to quote Don Juan again.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that both you and I, we've had careers and then they've changed. And here we are. We join up many years later to do a podcast, talking about the same things, and you know,
the same connection.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just kind of strange. I only really got in touch with you a month or two ago.
Yeah, it's been very recent.
Yeah, and it's funny. A lot of things are happening to both of us, and it's really good to be in touch with you again and see the kind of work you're doing and you know, just to want to be able to help people and you know, I sort of feel it's like, yeah, I don't care so much anymore. I just need to speak my truth. And at the same time, I'm not sure what that is, but I'm exploring it. Yeah, I'm letting it go and just saying one needs to trusting in yourself, I suppose, and this great, amazing world. So
definitely part of my soul group, Carl.
Oh, well,
you know, have about eight or so people living right now that were part of my soul group. You were definitely, there's a reason we were able to reconnect after decades.
Yeah. Well, I, I remember when we first met, and well, I nearly killed you in the company when I couldn't find a drill bit. It was after work, and you were doing overtime. And I slipped an old file in the chuck, turned it on, and the thing went screaming across the room. And
oh my God, I remember.
Yeah, I missed your head, and that's how we. That was a very manly, introduction. Sorry about that. No problem.
Oh, I completely forgot about that. I was working on a circuit that Angel had designed that would not even work.
Ah, yeah, that's what it was. So, Bill, any last words before we get you back here? Is there any contact details or websites or anything? Is that in development or?
I'm in development right now because I'm in a, because I've made the decision to move. I have other more mundane priorities I need to move on right now, and my plan was by the end of next year. I don't want to wait that long. I'm anxious to get the hell out of Dodge. And begin my life fresh.
It's I identify with that. A lot can be said about that.
I would just begin and end with saying that separateness is an illusion. That once we die, we're all part of the same unit. There are no hidden thoughts. While we're here, it's to see how we behave if we were separate. Some people behave well, some people behave badly. But don't take it seriously. Work on yourself, everything will turn out. But the point is, we're not really separate.
Doing
to others as you would have them doing to you, it's all based upon that principle.
Yeah, exactly. It's recognizing the God and the other person. We're all
right. We're not separate from God. We distance ourselves from God.
We get locked in that head, that way of thinking, and
misused ego.
And as a society, we've got locked into that way of thinking. And one of my things is to kind of catch these perceptions that have gone slightly astray, like that we're separate from nature. It was, you know, what I say, which is the same as what you're saying in many regards, and to recognize that we are nature because we evolved with it, right? Environment of nature. So Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, talking to you. And what else can I say?
That's been an honor.
Yeah, great stuff. I hope to have you back again.
We scratched the surface a bit. You know, we can come back to. I can fill in more details, give you a more clearer picture of home.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reasons why things are the way they are.
We could also have a podcast on Carlos Castaneda. You know, because that was. But anyway, we'll wrap this up because I know we'll just keep going. And
time for another cup of coffee.
Yeah, I'm going to get some more. Okay, Bill, all the best, man. You take care of yourself. And
thanks, Carl. You do the same.
All right, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
Enjoy the day.
Cheerio.